This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Master Wu Man's Gateless Gate, Case 38, A Buffalo Passes Through a Window, Part 2. Master Wu Tzu Fayan said, to give an example, it's like a buffalo passing through a window. Its head, horns, and four legs have all passed through. Why is it that its tail cannot? The commentary. If you can penetrate to the point of this koan and open up your Dharma eye to it, give a turning word, you'll then be able to repay the four obligations above and help the three existences below. If you still cannot do so, work with this tale single-heartedly until you can really grasp it as your own. Woman's poem. If it passes through, it falls into a ditch. If it turns back, it's destroyed. This tiny tale, how extremely marvelous. So for those of you who've joined in the last day or so, the first talk I gave was on this koan, and I said that I wanted to use it over the next couple of talks, today and Sunday, to look at this koan and also how it speaks of the path in Buddha Dharma and the sort of natural development of understanding in training. You know, since the beginning of time, I would guess, since there have been human beings, people have had experiences that were non-ordinary. Mystical experiences, touching, glancing blows, or sort of kissing, something that is beyond our ordinary perceiving of things and our capacity to explain. And I read from the Christian Wiman poet's comment the other day, who said that these intense experiences that we have lead some of us to spiritual practice because they demand something of us. They demand to be attended to be examined, to be lived, clarified. And so what happens in practice and training is not that, because there is no sort of manufacturing of such experiences, there's no way to construct such experiences in any kind of methodical way, because by their very nature, they are non-constructed. It's through the falling away of the constant constructing of reality, of what we might call our domesticated reality, our conditioned reality, that this ultimate, raw, unadorned, undomesticated, wild reality is revealed. And so in training, we enter into various forms of practices that are integrated or expressions of teachings that have come down to us. This is our, in a sense, the inheritance from one generation to the next, is this body of teachings and practices that have developed in each particular school, tradition, lineage of the Dharma to bring one directly to those teachings, to these teachings, to these direct experiences of what we call reality. this koan, as I mentioned, in Hakuin's organizing of the koan system that he did some hundreds of years ago, he called it an anto koan, which means it's not easy, it's difficult, more difficult than others, more difficult than it might seem. And the difficulty of the koan is always in the mind of the practitioner. There is no other difficulty. It's not in the language, it's not in the ideas, but it's in the language and the ideas in our mind and what we do. And so in that way, the koans are kind of exquisite offerings of the Dharma to study and pass through. And the only way that we can do that is when all sense of self and other, of practitioner and koan, of practice and realization, of process and goal dissolves. So this great bulky buffalo, this big, bumbling, bulky buffalo, its head, its horns, its four legs all pass through. Just one of these tiny little windows. But its tail can't. Now, some of you have come in with this, having reflected on or sat with this koan and have various things to say, which is wonderful. No, I mean that in terms of, you know, engaging it. And I mean, it means you're actually listening to the talk. And some of you have argued over it. Why does the tail need to pass through? Doesn't need to pass through, you know, and so on. And so it's like, okay, to engage it, you have to enter into it, right? It's not a legal debate. So there has to be some faith in which you enter into the reality that the koan is presenting you with. There is a buffalo. It has all passed through this tiny window, but its tail cannot. That's the reality that the koan asks you to enter into. I also, in the previous talk, was drawing from Musō Soseki's teachings. This is a 13th, 14th century master, Japanese master, who was talking about these three forms of compassion. Compassion based on sentient beings, compassion based on Dharma, and compassion based on no object. And so previously I talked a little bit about that perspective of compassion based on sentient beings, which is basically practice and understanding based on sentient beings. And the way he spoke of it is that when we offer compassion, when we practice, based on the belief that what we're facing within ourselves, in other people, is real. Real in the sense that it has its own nature, its inherent nature. It has a nature inherent to it. Right? And so different emotions have different characteristics that are inherent to the emotion. That means when that emotion happens, those qualities are there, and there's nothing you can do about it other than avoid it, conquer it, give it to somebody else. In other words, when it has an inherent quality in the thing itself, then the normal ways we have of responding make sense, right? Which is distancing or infatuation, if it's something good. And so what he's, this form of compassion, when we're working with other people and trying to help them, trying to serve, makes things very difficult. Because if we believe in the inherent quality of the person's suffering, and the suffering as an inherent part of that person, and the difficulty as having inherent challenges, I mean, you know, there's stuff you can do, but you can only go so far because those things, all of those things are inherent in the thing itself. It's like when we see a characteristic in somebody and we sort of globalize that characteristic within the person. They're angry. They are an angry person. That's their nature. What can you do? Right? It's just who you are. And that's what identity is. Identity is the imputing, not just qualities, but the inherent value in qualities that we see within ourselves and other things. And so from that perspective, then why can't the tail pass through? And so if you think of these, you know, we enter into practice and there's all kinds of, there are reasons why we enter into practice, right? On some level, maybe on many levels, things aren't quite working out. Our life isn't quite going the way we thought it was going to go. Right? It's not the fulfillment of the dream. That if we do this, we get this. If you get this, you have happiness and joy. It's not working out that way. And so we enter into practice motivated by whatever those are in each of us. And so the head and the horns and the legs of this, all of these, this bulk of this buffalo are these significant karmic burdens that we carry with us, that arise because of the things we experience in our lives, the difficulties, the pain, the violence, the challenges. But through practice, dedicated, sincere, steady, trusting practice, those big hulking aspects of our karmic baggage begin to pass through. Right? They go through transformations. But this tail, this tiny little tail, it's a big buffalo, but here's a little tiny little tail. Right? It's hardly even worthy of calling it a tail. It's tiny. Why won't it pass through? And what is that tail? Buddhism, the Dharma speaks of this, understands this, these underlying dispositions, these difficult aspects. And whether you understand them as, you know, ancient within this life or ancient within many lives, these aspects that you practice and they reappear. You practice and they reappear. You practice and they reappear. And it's easy to think, practice doesn't work. I'm not doing something right. All right? This is not correct. There it is. The tail that won't pass through. And so in this second form of compassion, Musō Saseki says, compassion based on Dharma is that which clearly perceives the illusory nature of all sentient and non-sentient existence that arises through dependent origination. It is an illusory compassion that teaches illusory Dharma gates to liberate illusory sentient beings. This is the compassion of the Mahayana Bodhisattva. Although it no longer entertains substantialist views, it's no longer tricked by the appearance of things into thinking that there is inherent substance, inherent qualities, and is therefore, having gone beyond sentimental compassion, this type of compassion is still not true compassion because it adheres to the concept of non-substantiality. So here the practitioner has traveled from seeing the substantiality of all things, everything is, everything has its own self, its own sort of permanent nature. And so if it's a good thing, you want to hold it because it's permanent. It's permanently good. And if you hold on to it, it will be permanently good for you. but that doesn't quite work out. Or if it's negative, you want to keep it far away because it's permanently negative. That doesn't work out either. But here, the practitioners realized the non-substantiality of things. And so is practicing an illusory compassion based in illusory dharma that liberates illusory sentient beings. Now, illusory here means something that is easily perceived wrongly and correctly by the senses. I mean, that's what illusory actually means. So it has an appearance, but the appearance itself is deceiving. It fools us. We get fooled by the appearance. It's something which can be perceived. We are seeing something, we're experiencing something, but ultimately has no substantial existence. We take what we see, those qualities, as the thing itself. And so, when I am experiencing this, when that's my experience, this is what I'm experiencing. Right? From that first perspective, based in sentient beings and in seeing the reality of all things, what looms large, what's significant here is this is. I am. And that these endless, endless moments of experience through all of our six senses is constantly reaffirming, recreating, resubstantiating this sense that there is something there. It is. It has a self, it has a soul, it has permanence, it has autonomy. And there is someone who is experiencing it. I am. I am. I am. And so, moment after moment, as things arise, what is practice? So the Buddha said, avoid the extremes. What are the extremes? To deny this, this is not happening. That's not true. And so to see, to just see. And then to not grasp. Right? So to not deny, to not say, no, this is not happening, but not to affirm either, as in, come closer, I want to hold you. And so step by step, it's like the leaves of the tree drop off. The leaves are what catch the sunlight and catch the wind. And as they drop off, the wind just blows through the empty branches. The light just passes easily. But the root's still there. The root is firmly embedded in the ground. And so to illuminate, to enlighten the mind, is to see clearly what has been wrongly perceived. Now, this is not because of our senses. It's not that they're not doing their job. They are. But remember that senses are not just the organ and not just the object that the organ perceives, but it's consciousness. And so there is eye consciousness and nose consciousness and tongue consciousness. That is the consciousness which is perceiving that specific through that specific window. And so then it's the consciousness which has had, 100 billion experiences, which have informed it about what this is, what this is, what this is. And of course, messages and teachings and, all of the stuff that we've heard and been taught and learned. And all of that is held within consciousness. And so consciousness is, even though our eyes maybe are always seeing something fresh for the first time, our consciousness is bringing in all of this history. And so when student asks Master Fayan, what is the one drop of Bayou in your teacher? What is one drop of true Dharma? And Bayun said, pounding, grinding. This is the steady, diligent practice. This is what practice is. Moment by moment, day by day, month by month, year by year, aware, one awareness, one moment, one letting go, one returning. What appears, we attend to. What appears, we practice. All the while letting go of what is wrongly perceived. That's why it's so important not to judge. Because our judgments are based in what we believe, right? Which is what's working together in concert with our perceptions. So when we lay our judgments on things, what we're essentially saying is, I know what's true. I know what's real. I know what's supposed to be happening. I know what this is. I know where this is going. I know. And the fact is, I don't know. I am not clearly perceiving. And if I'm not clearly perceiving, that's because my consciousness is laying on to that clear perception false ideas. And so how could my judgments be true guides? And so to release those, so that the mind more and more is able, that consciousness is more and more able to just see directly. And so the student says, well, how is it once you've drunk that drop of Bayun? And Fayan says, I teach of a place where no face appears, going down all the way to the root, seeing the illusion within the illusion. All of it is empty of a soul, including emptiness. The root is empty of root. The form is empty of form. Anger is empty of anger. There's an interesting story about Fayan that he told his song. He said, yesterday I went into town and I noticed a puppet show going on. I couldn't help but go over there and take a look. And this puppet was really something to see. At first, it seemed to move its limbs and walk around and sit down all on its own. But when I looked closer, I saw that there was somebody behind the curtain. And I couldn't help but call out, sir, what's your name? And the puppeteer replies and say, honored priest, just watch the show. Why ask for names? And then Fayan says, friends, when I heard him say this, I didn't have a single word to say in reply. Not a single idea. Can any of you think of anything to say in my place? Yesterday, that single instance of embarrassment uprooted all of my ideas. Just watch the show. The puppeteer says, why ask for names? Indeed, before a single stirring, before a sight, a sound, a name, a description, a comparison, a judgment, before knowing, how is it? I teach of a place where no face appears. I teach of a person who is a person of no rank. One complete letting go, one absolute moment, one undivided activity. This trust, this release, relinquishing. And so you can see why you can't force it. And so when the mind is very active and restless, the Buddha talked about, you know, like taking a rope and tethering a rope to each of the senses. And then the other end of the rope you tether to a stake in the ground, and then you plant it firmly. And he was talking about mindfulness. And so if you think of each of those senses as an animal, you know, one wants to fly, one wants to swim, one wants to just barrel its way through the woods to get away. Right? But they're tethered. And so they keep straining at the rope, straining at the rope, and eventually what happens? They get worn out. They stop fighting. They just lay down, go to sleep. And so it's that sense of tethering, right? Not, which is not forceful, right? The rope itself, if it's tied well, it just holds that creature, each creature, right? So that it can't run wild. And so that's essentially what every one of us has to be discovering within our own zazen, is how do you hold yourself? How do you hold that stability within your mind without that kind of forcefulness, right? Which just ties you up more into knots. But if the knot is too loose, off they go. What is that middle way? And so we can see why, you know, life is dukkha. Dukkha is because you don't get what you want. I mean, it's shocking how simple. It's like, okay, the first noble truth. Oh, all right, what is it? What is it? What is it? You don't get what you want. Really? Really? That's it? Pretty much. Pretty much you can kind of all bring it back to that, you know, like since we were two. But because we're just like when we were two, we didn't just sit down and shut up. We let hell loose, right? The world is filled with conflict. The world is the mirror of our mind. And Christian Wiman's, this interview that I was listening to, he quotes another writer, but he says, we've deflected the soul. We might think of our true nature. He's a Christian, so he's thinking in terms of soul. We've deflected the soul or our Buddha nature into questions of the self. And then he quotes Fanny Howe, who says, the self has replaced the soul with the fist of survival. He says that we've created a kind of climate in which, in order to survive, we have to hone ourselves for battle. And so we develop and hone ourselves and project those selves in all kinds of various ways, whether it's Facebook or whatever. We think of our lives as being successful to the extent that those selves are ratified by other people. And we've gotten away from the notion of our soul. And I think what he means by that is a true spiritual life. A life that is questioning, that is seeing, that is examining, that is taking responsibility, that understands what's important and understands what's not important. And I like that the self has replaced our nature with the fist of survival. And so life becomes a battleground. And of course, we bring that here. And that's why session is so important, because everything is stripped away. Right, the moment we get and stuff start get up and things start happening, even in silence, right? How quickly it can become somebody else's fault. And even here, the Jigido takes lots of hits. Right? Not paying attention, not ringing the bell. He must be asleep. My legs are hurting. The monitors, the temperature, the food, the company. But because there's no activity, it's hard to keep that up, right? It's hard to believe in it forever. So we can see. And this notion of we think we're successful to the extent that we have ourselves ratified. Can we take a vote, please? Can we ratify this, right? Right? And of course, maybe the vote comes in your favor, maybe it doesn't. So life is dukkha means everything is infused with this sense of conflict. Losing, gaining, failing, succeeding. Who am I? Who are you? How do we compare? Multiple layers. And that's just, you know, a basic, easy life. And then when you add that, the compounded pain through real suffering, the suffering of oppression, of violence, of a chaotic home, of addiction, of all of the things that we create within our homes, between each other, within institutions, in nations, between nations. The head, horns, and legs must pass through. What about the tail? What's interesting is when things appear real, there's distance. That's what distance looks like. There is separation. That's what separation looks like. Things take on a kind of absolute quality. And so even when we're angry, for instance, we know that we're angry, but we don't know anger. And the more angry we become, the more distant it is. Isn't that curious? And the more distant it is, the more entangled we get. Isn't that even more curious? So it's clearly not a geographical thing. When that distance begins to close, when we learn how to practice anger, to know anger, when that distance begins to dissolve, the anger is seen. It passes through the window. The Buddha said, was talking about what is beneficial, just at any time, in any place. How do you know if something is beneficial for you? And he said, whatever leads to disenchantment, dispassion, cessation, peace, direct knowledge, and enlightenment. And so disenchantment and dispassion. And so disenchantment is to not be enchanted, not to be filled, not to be charmed, not to be under a spell. That's kind of an interesting way of thinking of, you know, our relationship to our mind, to our thoughts, to our memories, to our emotions, as we become in the spell. And the root word of enchantment is incantare. It's a Latin word which means to sing. And so to think of being sort of sung into, that what's arising is singing us into a kind of trance. And so to break that, to be disenchanted, I am no longer enchanted. I hear the sound of this song. It is no longer beautiful. And dispassion is the disengagement, right? Detachment. That because it is no longer beautiful, I am no longer in the grips of my afflictions. But it may be hard to give up. It's hard to give up that enchantment because when that's all we know, it seems like that's what life is. And so we're willing to take the lows because we get the highs. And what the Buddha is saying, has said from the beginning, is, you know, those highs, they're not actually so high. When that's all we know, that's all we know. But if we have faith and we practice disenchanting ourselves, then we taste true peace, true contentment, true pleasure, true satisfaction. And so to see through into the illusory nature of things, using illusory dharma, and practicing this illusory body and mind, and serving, manifesting compassion towards illusory sentient beings, means to no longer do so under the spell. To see things as they are is to no longer be within a kind of state, trance. And within that, things are bright and luminous, radiant and clear. And that's what realization is seeing beyond our wrongly held perceptions, experiencing directly, one undivided moment. There's a miscellaneous koan that says, sitting in the room in absolute silence, mind source unmoved, like still water. The striking of thunder opens the gate of the head's crown. Beginningless self-nature has been awakened. In absolute silence, sitting in a room, this room, in absolute silence, that's in your mind. We practice silence so that you can return to this absolute silence which is in your mind. It's your natural mind, where your mind source is unmoved, filled like still water. When a body of water is filled and undisturbed, it's got weight, solidity, stability. It's powerful. The striking of thunder is that leaping beyond the gates of perception to see into the empty nature of things. And here to, again, practice the extremes. Don't ignore, don't grasp. And so at every step along the way to, as we have all kinds of naturally occurring experiences that are a result of your practice, to see and to pass through. To see and to pass through. To not grasp. This faith mind says, one thing, all things move amidst and intermingle. Don't stop. Because when you make the smallest distinction, that which has been realized as one becomes divided again. Hakuin wrote a nice poem commenting on this tiny tale. He says, always the same is the moon before the window. Yet if only a plum branch appears, it's no longer the same. The tiniest, even though it's beautiful, when it appears before the moon, it's not the same. But if all things are empty of any inherent characteristic, which means things inherently have no power to obstruct, then why won't the tail pass through? What is the window? What is this tail? Master Dogen on this tail wrote, the world is but the tail of a buffalo passing through a window. The tail is your mind, which knows neither passing nor not passing. This whole world is nothing but the tail of a buffalo passing through a window. From the beginning, there has been nothing but this tail passing through. Things are not as they seem. Everywhere, sincere people want to be free and yet return again and again to the causes of their suffering. Practitioners dedicated to practice, having let go of many great burdens, can't bring the tale across. Something is there. Things are not as they seem, nor are they otherwise. That means they are as they seem. Things are not as they seem. Things are as they seem. And that so beautifully and pointedly expresses the fact that we cannot resolve this with our thinking mind. Remember that mind is one of the sense organs. It perceives things. We have to stop perceiving things in order to understand things. How is all of this essential to compassion? When beings are suffering, and their suffering is real, all we can do really is sort of manage the load. It's like if you have a really heavy pack on and you have a really long journey, like forever, then what can you do? Right? You can shift it around, you know, sort of move it to one side, but then the other side, that side starts hurting. So then you move it to the other side, but eventually that side starts hurting. So you sort of just keep jockeying it back and forth. You can stop and just do a lot of, you know, weight training, build up your legs, build up your back, become very fit. But it's still heavy, and it gets heavier as you go. You can take medication, right? Try and make the pain go away. You can try and get somebody else to carry the pack, but they've got their own. You can put it on somebody else's back, and you've still got your own pack. So what happens when we realize that that pack, that this suffering, this, you know, yesterday I think it was saying, mentioned the difference between pain and suffering. This is very important. That as long as we have a physical body, we and nerve endings, we will experience things. Pain and pleasure. To alleviate suffering, to liberate ourselves from suffering, is to liberate ourselves from the suffering that we create within pain and pleasure. And so as though Suzuki said, this is Mahayana Bodhisattva compassion, because it's based in the understanding that self and other, suffering and liberation are empty of any inherent quality. But it's not yet true compassion because it's attached to that. And that's limiting because it can deny the experience of suffering that people have. It can deny the responsibility that we have to each other. It can deny the forms of suffering that are real and that are functioning at so many different levels. And so the journey continues. That's why there is training. You know, in our culture, we're so hooked on experience, right? And I think the more enchanted we become, the more distracted, but more than distraction, the more fragmented we are. The more we have systematically rendered asunder some of the basic fabrics of life that have been part of the human community forever and have helped people to find meaning in life. And our lives become more and more lost. You know what I read at the beginning of the week? That since the beginning of the year, there have been 11 violent shootings in schools in this country so far this year. This is the cry. And so to come back at a very simple level, I was talking about experiences. And so we, in our confusion, in our lostness, we seek, and our sort of the sense of not, on some level, not being alive. Right? That life doesn't matter. And so we seek moments of strong experiences to sort of give us that sense of, no, I'm alive. I'm alive. And so we can bring that into practice because the Dharma speaks of powerful experiences that transform our lives. And we can sort of enchant ourselves with the idea, if I just have one of those. Right? I'm not greedy. Just one big one. That will save me. That will save me from me and save me from you. But I want to be saved. I want to be delivered. I want to be rescued. I want someone or something to take this away. That's not what practice is. That's not what it's ever been. That's not what the Dharma teaches. But that doesn't mean that it's not a path of liberation. That lives are not profoundly changed. Your life, my life. What is that middle path between the illusion, right, of indifference, apathy, cynicism, and the illusion of I'm going to get what's mine? And so we'll look at this again on Sunday. This tiny tale, how extremely marvelous. What is your tale? You may have more than one. The great way is nowhere to be found. This is speaking of this form of compassion. He doesn't need this. He already knows. The great way is nowhere to be found. An echoless valley, a withered tree on a frozen plain. Free of head and horns, what tale would you have me pass? This peace is not yet true peace. When you call, I will not answer. The embarrassment is mine. Practice must continue. This peace is not yet true peace. When you call, I don't answer from this place. And that embarrassment is mine. So let's continue really practicing. It's been a good, strong session. Let's really keep practicing well. And appreciate, you know, what Shane talked about yesterday, those basic reminders of what it means to have human life. Right? We forget. And so you practice remembering. Remembering is a practice. Remembering is mindfulness. In moments of indifference or, you know, just laziness or dullness, remember. Remember. This life is fleeting. It is remarkable. It is marvelous. There's work to be done. There are cries that are calling out. There is a wondrous life to be lived. So to lose our enchantment and taste the sweet spring water.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.mro.org.